Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for coming to this session. My name is Julianne Schultz. I'm the editor of Griffith Review, and I'm going to chair this session in a very, very light-handed fashion, which is going to be a conversation between two of my favourite Griffith Review authors, Robin Williams and Murray Sale. Robin's well known to all of you. He's a living national treasure, no less, and one of the most important voices in science and one of the best broadcasters in the country. Murray Sale is also a living national treasure, but unlike Robin, I don't think he's got a badge to prove it, but trust me, he deserves one. Murray is one of the most distinguished journalists this country's produced, and we're fortunate that after many decades of living abroad, travelling and reporting the world, and for many years living in Japan, he's relatively recently returned to Australia. This will be a conversation between the two of them about the topic of the day, climate change or global warming. Robin is regularly interviewing scientists on the radio about this most pressing of subjects. Indeed, I heard one last night. But few have been able, I think, to bring the narrative voice about the narrative force of a life devoted to finding out about stuff that Murray has in his remarkable essay in the current issue of Griffith Review. Before they start, I want to tell you a little bit about the genesis of this essay and the special links it has to a festival which is devoting so much emphasis to the celebration of the New Yorker, partly because I know that Murray will be too modest to say so himself. But in the talk about the New Yorker, there's been a number of discussions about how Mark Danner's essay was one of the few times the New Yorker gave over its whole number to a particular single author. Well, Murray also wrote an essay that was given over to the whole issue of the New Yorker, and that was a piece that marked the 50th anniversary of the end of the Second World War and the bombing of Hiroshima, and in which he wrote a reprise of from a Japanese perspective on Hiroshima and whether it was really needed to end the war and its significance. As with this essay, his conclusions in that piece do not provide much comfort to either side of the prevailing established viewpoint. So briefly, let me just tell you how this essay on the rise of hydrocarbon civilization came about. A couple of years ago, after Murray had finished his long essay that we ran in The Lure of Fundamentalism this time last year, we were talking about the need to be able to write about big international topics, but with an Australian accent. Murray was at the time recalling his visits to Tasmania and the importance of Cape Grim, the monitoring station that's run by CSIRO for the World Monitoring Station, World Monitoring of Weather, and the uniqueness of our fossil fuel economy in this whole debate. We thought there might be an organising principle to write about climate change with the sort of principle of the settlement of Australia, sort of coinciding with the rise of the Industrial Revolution. But as with all the essays that Murray takes on, the idea grew and grew as he searched for the fundamental questions. About this time last year, The New Yorker ran a very impressive series about climate change by Mary Colbert. And shortly afterwards, Tim Flannery's important book came out, and Barry Pittock, who's one of the Australian representatives on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, also wrote an important book about climate change, less celebrated than Tim's, but very important nonetheless. And several things jumped out at us from these books and the New Yorker article. The first was that for people to be able to get over the hump of the science, there was a need for a new narrative that sort of put climate change into a context. And from Mary's articles in the New Yorker, two things seemed particularly interesting. One was the importance of Holland as a case study in living with rising sea levels over many centuries, how that country had to adjust to climate change for a very long period of time. And the other was the juxtaposition of the lead ad in that one of the issues of the New Yorker that featured Mary Colbert's pieces. It was an ad by ExxonMobil about the good things it was doing for the environment. Not long later, Exxon declared its 2005 profit, which was a new all-time record of $50 billion. This made Murray think about the underlying issues shaping climate change were bigger and deeper than we've come to imagine, and that there was more at stake than just switching to solar. So he's constructed a wide-ranging narrative around the subject that travels from Cape Grim back to the development of global capitalism, the discovery of Australia by the Dutch 400 years ago, and onto the four horsemen of the apocalypse. It's a big canvas, so I'll hand it over to these two experts.
Thank you. I just want to start with two paragraphs, one from Murray, from this book, edited by Julianne, and the other one from somewhere else. Cape Grim Baseline Air Pollution Station is a modest collection of prefab huts atop a blackened tooth of sandstone that juts from the northwestern corner of Tasmania into the Southern Ocean at latitude 40 degrees 41 miles south. This is uncomfortably inside the roaring forties, the winds that blow clear around the globe with only a short passage over the distant wilds of Patagonia, raising swells that break with few pauses on two saw-toothed islets at Grimm's Foot, 94 metres below. Above the huts which house a rotating team of nine scientists and their instruments, soars a slender steel tower with air intake sampling the winds at 104 metres and 164 metres above the sea. So that's the Griffith Review. Here is the opening paragraph of chapter 2 of a certain novel. Cape Grimm is on the top left-hand shoulder of Tasmania, where the wind flattens the long yellow grass, making it grow horizontally, and where sheep huddle together in vain to escape the constant withering blast. The weather station, properly called the Baseline Monitoring Station, is built near the cliff with just a narrow dirt road to link it to the rest of the property, one of those grand traditional farms still maintained in that part of Australia, a vestige of past glories. The farm itself is cut off from the surrounding countryside, and you cannot officially approach the station without permission, though once you are through the gate, there are few people to stop you. That paragraph is from my novel 2007, and I never went near Cape Grimm, I just made up the lot. I mean, you can do that in novels. I mean, Len Dayton used to study all those aircraft and the guns and get all the nuts and bolts right. When I'm writing something like that, I just invent it. Have you been to Cape Grimm, Murray?
No.
Never?
I've been on on the property of the Van Diemen's Land Company, but I've never actually been to Cape Grimm.
You've never been to the station?
No, they won't let you go there.
They won't let you go? I didn't realise that.
No fear. Tourist pollution.
I see. Well, you got... So, did you get all those details from pictures or...
They have a website with some terrific pictures on them.
Ah, I see. Well, come to websites, because one of your pursuits of websites worries me slightly, but we'll come to that later. I just want to mention that this is a reunion that... it must go back 40 years, because when my...
So many things do.
I know, there's so many... We've entered the prostate years, but don't worry about that. When my lot were leaving Oxford and I'd just come back, I think I'd come back from Australia in something like 1967, late 66, 67. The bunch of tearaways had a flat in Chelsea, which they got for £5.10 a week, would you believe? And they used to have parties all the time, and one of the figures who loomed coming from Fleet Street, always carrying a bottle of scotch like a gun on his hip, was Murray Sale. Yeah. And all these smart asses stopped joshing around because he was the legend. He was the and am I right? It was the Sunday Times, and the Sunday Times had a whole bunch of people like Philip Knightley,
yeah,
and Bruce, what's his name, who used to edit the Insight team.
Page.
Bruce Page.
We're not speaking.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry about that. What I don't know is, despite your status as a journalist, such to take our breath away, your background in science. Now, the essay here is so authoritative, I learned something in every paragraph.
Thank you.
No, really. About...
Well, you know the University of New South Wales?
Yeah.
There is another university in Sydney.
What?
Called the University.
Right.
We leave the rest off.
Yeah.
Now, they used to teach scientific subjects. Not very well, but they did their best. I was actually studying... I mean, that's what I was really doing, editing the student paper, but I actually did psychology.
You did psychology?
Yeah, I don't know you'd call that a science, but...
You would, yeah.
These were in the days of rats and stats.
Yeah.
And which put everybody off, and the factor of general intelligence, and so on.
Yes.
But from there, that only got me started. I've been reading the Scientific American compulsively ever since, until they went down market, and try to keep up with it.
Well, I think they're still pretty damn impressive, because I have the editor of Scientific American on my wireless program. He's on last week. And it's a prettier magazine. It's not quite as didactic. But I want to know the material that you got on climate change for this essay and for indeed that graph, which is...
The graph comes from the Sydney Morning Herald, that well-known scholar.
Yes, but the essay around it is... how much have you been worrying about climate over the years?
Not at all, until quite recently. I'm like everybody else. I thought it was a good thing to have children. You're returning your debt to, you know, the Costello line.
Yes.
And I've never got over the idea that if you don't have children of your own wiping your bottom in old age, somebody else's children will be wiping your bottom in old age, that we have that kind of obligation. And I think I confess in these notes here, I owned an 6-cylinder, 8-wheel, 8-passenger SUV, and I've been all over the outback in cars of different kinds. And I understood that the story of national development, which, by the way, continues to be very central to... See, we're in a very bad country to think about climate change. We're, in a way, in a very good one, but in a way, a ridiculous one. Where is the water coming up that wasn't always coming up, etc.? But...
how many years do you think? When did the click happen when you thought this is a real problem?
When I first went to Tasmania.
When was that?
Shortly after the massacre at Port Arthur.
10 years ago?
Yeah. And then I did, for the first time, went down to the Gordon River.
Hmm.
And for the first time stood on the, which disappeared, I'm afraid, out of the piece, Ocean Beach, Nistrawn, which is where... Tasman made his landfall on Zeehan, and you can still see them, Zeehan and Heemskerk, the two extinct volcanoes.
Yeah.
And had the wind in my face, and went up in the direction of Cape Grim, but never actually got to the Cape itself because they won't let you, and began to brood on the subject. And from there it's become, like as Julian will tell you, one of my compulsions.
Yes. Now, make the connection with population. You mentioned children. Most people don't necessarily do what Paul Ehrlich did in the population bomb in 1968, show how everything is contingent on the number of bodies there are. For example, I interviewed the person who was making a projection for the United Nations. He's actually based in Vienna. And he was the person who was saying we're probably going to reach about 9.5 billion before the population stabilizes. And he said one of the biggest problems when it comes to pollution and conservation and all those is divorce, because there's an awful lot of divorce in the Western world, so you have twice the number of households. So you don't have the children necessarily looking after you in one great big house, but in several ones, each with their own white goods, their own chimneys, their own SUVs outside. It is connected, is it not? The climate change and the problems of the environment and sheer numbers on Earth.
I call it the farmer's insurance policy. And by the way, I think doing a bit of introspection, which I'm a great believer on, always being scolded by Andersonians for doing that, we all feel great interest in our children and a fair interest in our grandchildren, and no interest whatever in what follows after that.
Mm.
And I think that goes back to the Stone Age, because they were our insurance policy. If we lived long enough, the children and perhaps the grandchildren would give us something to eat. Beyond that, we wouldn't be around. We didn't care. Now, of course, we, in a self-congratulatory way, we care about the destiny of humanity and so on, but we're much more concerned with our own personal interests.
Yes.
But of the many, many topics we get over, which people were going to have to read the piece, I'm afraid. I know it's a long, punishing read, but there's no way out. From my interest in psychology, I am convinced, and I think this can be demonstrated, all of our emotions come from the Stone Age, without any exception. Inside our heads, we live in a small tribe. We hate everybody who isn't in the tribe. We have to go and steal their women if we're of that appropriate gender from time to time in order to get the gene pool up to the minimal 6,000. Otherwise, we hate them and they hate us, and we've got to do them in. And you can see this played 5 times a night on television. The good guys do. The evil, rotten, bad guys who belong to some other tribe and are not human. Whereas our lot, with all their... look at the bill, with all their terrible faults. They're just like us. Now, unfortunately, we've got to the situation in which the rock under our feet is not big enough to carry all these people.
Yes.
So the four horsemen have failed us.
Let me just expand on that piece of psychology. Do you know how many people it takes holding hands to go back from now, 21st century, to the Stone Age, say the beginning of civilization 10,000 years
generations
ago?
Generations. I could work, if I better mental arithmetic, I could work it out, but you're going to tell us.
I'm going to tell you it's about 400.
Yeah.
So four times the number of people in this room holding hands goes back to before civilization. I mean, that's tiny. That's insignificant. And we're just a blink of an eye away. And most of the things to do with the technology, these little wires and the mobile phones that people insist on owning, most of that's only been around for half a generation, half of my life. So much is new, and we've got an awareness only of the last few minutes, whereas we're asking, with this understanding of climate change and the future, to think in terms of hundreds of years, and you're saying that that is possibly beyond us.
Well, it couldn't be presented that way. We might perhaps get some action if we could present this as yet another battle for the good guys, us versus the bad guys, those other rotten bastards. But we're already well involved in a war on exactly that subject, you might recall. So that the prospect of deciding there might be something in there. I had to give a talk at the an elegy or eulogy for a photographer friend of mine. And I, thinking about it, thought, I've never ever met a right-wing photographer. Photographers are all either...
Lenny Riefenstahl,
Well, why? We'll get into Lenny in a moment. It's perfectly possible to kill somebody without looking at them, right, from an aeroplane, for instance. It's very difficult to take their photograph without looking at them. And if you want one of those sexy close-ups, you get it quite close to them. You see that they are a person like yourself, and you are sharing their environment, briefly. Therefore, the evil, rotten, bad guys they're supposed to be somehow fades away.
Mm.
Lenny's a difficult case, isn't she? Made pretty good movies.
Brilliant.
Wound up, as you know, a photographer for the Sunday Times.
Did you meet her there?
No, briefly when she... Yeah. But I didn't discuss German politics with her. This was part of the... Well, this gets us off the climate change, but
you'll be back very quickly.
The dangerous modernity of National Socialism and the amazing frumpiness of its opponents... there's something... The arts are not democratic. On the contrary, they're extremely authoritarian, right? Most of the best architecture in the world has been put up by fascist dictators or by the author of the Shah Jahan, who then did his architect in, as you remember, so that he couldn't make one for someone else.
Yes.
But this again, we're getting now into psychology of the notion, which I attack vigorously in this, I hope with some success, that the invisible hand that guides our investments on the stock exchange is the hand of God, strikes me as the most ridiculous assertion. And yet that's precisely what von Mises and the Austrian school say. It is true that human beings exchange where other creatures don't. As Adam Smith said, nobody ever saw a dog trade a bone with another dog. But the notion that that can be erected into a moral system strikes me as absurd.
I want to bring you back to politics and the politics of climate change that you actually do address to some extent. And I want to ask you, when it's presented, for example, you mentioned the internet. Now, in your handout there, you talk about Benny Pieser, P-E-I-S-E-R.
Great man, yeah.
Who operates from the Liverpool University.
Yeah.
And I get at least one, perhaps two of his emails, new sheets a day. And most of them, if they're not about some non-threatening asteroid from outer space,
yeah,
are about the fact that climate change is crap and Kyoto is a waste of time. And he seems to be gathering...
He doesn't quite say that. He himself personally doesn't say anything much.
Well, I've heard him debate a number of people like Sir Crispin Tickell, but he's often quoting, for instance, that Tony Blair has perhaps given lip service to Kyoto and to climate change, yet their actions show that not only is Britain not meeting its goals, but also there seems to be a kind of skirmish away from what commitment they've made. Now, my actual question is, some people have suggested, especially in the Australian newspaper, that support of global warming as a concern is in fact something done by the watermelons. In other words, people who used to be red but are now green on the outside.
Yeah, yeah.
In other words, it's another left-wing plot.
Yeah.
How do you read it?
I'm afraid there's no escape from this, the graph. Okay. You might notice there have been roughly four. The low gas is low water, right? High gas, high water. Easy way to remember it. You'll notice that the low water has recurred pretty regularly for the past four cycles. So that's 450,000 years. But before that, the low water, before that, the high water failed twice. Now, if you keep coming along to the one that's 150,000 years ago, from there to where we are now is the entire history of the human, that is Homo sapiens sapiens species. Yeah.
That's when we came out of Africa.
Right. Now, we look a bit more, Conrad Lawrence said, wasn't it, that the missing link between the ape and Homo sapiens sapiens was man. If we keep going along, we notice that not only is the climate due to go up now, look at it, we're late. In other words, whatever is causing this may or may not have something to do with human beings, but it was going to happen anyway, judged on the basis, because the previous five, there were no human beings around. So we couldn't have had anything to do with it.
And the political point of that?
Therefore, the notion that somehow we can stop the climate getting warmer by turning off the lights at appropriate moments is ridiculous. The only question under discussion is whether or not human activity is forcing. Now, we have absolutely no way of deciding that. That is what Pieser is on about. There is no logical connection, because we don't know what causes this 120,000, approximately.
You mentioned Milankovitch in your essay.
Well, his cycle...
That's the earth wobble, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, you see, it gets terribly complicated with the terminology, but life is complicated. We're actually in 50 million years into the current Quaternary Ice Age. 50 million years, right? Rupert Murdoch wasn't around for it, etc. Now, as long as there are pillows of ice on Greenland and the Antarctic continent, we're in an ice age. When they melt, we're then in a snowball.
When they melt?
Other way round.
Yeah, okay.
The thing is, we're back to one universal ocean. That is, if we don't run into another galaxy, that's a new... What has happened is that the torrent of terrible things that might or might not happen is overwhelming us. It's like Noah's flood. Now, what Pieser is saying is, show me what is the operating mechanism, and no one can, because we haven't the faintest idea. What is this 120,000 years? It doesn't correspond to anything. It doesn't correspond to the continental drift. Mm. It doesn't correspond to anything having to do with the Earth's inclination, the Milankovitch problem. What is it? Why? Now, all right, you can say statistically. That's like the penny that having come up eight times heads, the next one has got to be a tail. And as you no doubt know from your gambling days, there are professionals who just want to get set on anybody who will offer a shade of odds that the next one won't be like all the others. And yet we do have parameters, forgive that word, between which this oscillates. Now we're into chaos mathematics. How on earth people can make up their minds about the reality of global warming or global human forcing of what is going to happen anyway.
And the implication of that, because you can't make up your mind because the science is uncertain, what should we do? Wait 100 years?
Well, I can tell you what we're going to do. I don't know about what we should do, because that gets us into theology. Another fascinating subject, by the way, which I'm most eager to talk about.
We'll do that one on Sunday.
Yeah, but I can tell you what we are going to do. Bugger all.
That's it.
Because the notion that, once again, unless we have climatologist kings operating in calm, this was the great problem that Keynes had. He was under the impression that the cyclical nature of the business cycle could be controlled by philosopher financiers wholly unaffected by the passions that afflict normal human beings. As Keynes himself said, in the long run we're all dead, which is just what you'd expect a childless homosexual to say, right? all dead, by the way.
He was a bisexual, had a very nice ballet dancer for a while.
I married her, if you look into it a bit more closely, to get her a passport. I mean, very nice of him. But
you were there at the time.
I was not there at the time. I don't think his sexual orientation is any of my business, except on this famous remark. Okay. The four horsemen have failed us. This is the heart of the problem. That the limitations that kept our particular species within some relationship to the available resources, I list them, but everyone knows what they are. Famine, how do they go? War, famine, pestilence, death. They all let us down. In the 20th century, supposedly the most violent we've ever seen, the population went from 1.5 billion to 6.5 billion. Despite wars, holocausts, bird flu, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, you go through the list, the Western Front, right. We're overdoing a good thing. We're too smart for our own good. Now, I don't think anybody will be shocked if I say that the unsustainable cannot be very long sustained. It's not one of the great breakthroughs, but you can put your feet on the ground there. It's like saying that people who live on islands tend to be insular in their outlook. This is an island, never forget. Okay. Something's got to give. Now, the long lists of things have been presented as to what's going to give. We're going to run out of oil. We're going to run out of coal. We're going to run out of uranium. Now we're going to run out of air, water. The water is, by the way, extremely... likely one.
Yep.
Something is going to reduce our numbers. Now, this is the heart of the problem. We either can do it by attrition, a nuclear kind, for instance. That's a likely way of getting started, because China, as you probably know, has now got 97 cities over 1 million population. Ideal nuclear targets. Marx was quite right when he said that industrialization and urbanization were one and the same thing, and that the bringing together of workers in a factory system, bringing the workpiece to the tool instead of the other way around, was going to create as he knew, as he correctly said, large accumulations of people. He was quite wrong about what they were going to do. Or was he? We're not sure.
I think I'm going to have a row with you about this, because this is a matter of timing. Yeah. If you go to China, as I've been once about 10 years ago, one of the main reasons I haven't been back is because of the authoritarian bastards who chase you around the Rialto and tell you how to behave. And the other is you can't breathe. The air pollution in these cities that you say is so bad that babies are dying at a rate higher than they do from dirty water. In other words, dysentery and such other things have now gone to number two. Number one is foul air because of the crap they put out in it as part of the system that produces excessive carbon dioxide.
We scientists call them dark satanic mills.
That's right, sure. Now, in China when I was there, the person who was running the environment was the daughter of Deng Xiaoping, yeah. Madame Nan Deng. And she said, you might be tremendously impressed by the Chinese miracle, which means we have a growth rate of 12%, but you can remove from that 8%, which is the environmental cost, the creation of deserts, the cost of people dying because of bad air, the fact that you've got chaos caused by windstorms and all that. I couldn't believe she was saying it in public. And that situation is just as bad today in China. Now, okay, in your essay you mention a number of things to do with carbon dioxide, parts per million, which you now put the figure as 380 parts per million.
I think I've got it in the piece here, yeah, whatever the current
on the famous graph, yeah. You've got things going up. Now, tomorrow, there are lots and lots and lots of ramifications of that CO2 increase. It's a bit like smoking cigarettes. The famous side effect is cancer of the lung, but there are about 50 others. Same with carbon dioxide. What I'm going to broadcast tomorrow from research, actually from Tasmania, CSIRO, Marine and Atmospherics, published evidence. My essay in this is about evidence, not politics, not the internet, but how they did the science. The consequences of CO2 increase. The oceans go more acid. The result of that, twofold. By the end of the century, a crumbling of barrier reefs, of coral reefs around the world by 30%. 30% of reefs fall apart. And the other consequences is the shellfish start dissolving because the ocean is acid.
I always use as a test.
I mean,
you're at the dentist, right?
Mm.
He approaches you with a drill. He says,
he's going to do that on Monday, by the way.
Right. Do you want some anaesthetic or shall we do it without anaesthetic? At the moment you signal for the anaesthetic, you have bought hydrocarbon civilization. At that moment you voted with your teeth.
Sure.
Because you can't have one bit without the other bit. That's the
sure.
problem. These very same Chinese who are coughing because the acid is eating the monuments away and so on are the same ones who want a television set, a walk,
sure.
mobile phone, etc. Wherever it has been tried, it has produced an irresistible demand by people, because until the game is up, it is a desirable state of affairs.
It might be desirable.
I'm going to take a taxi home.
We're not having a row about, nor is Clive Hamilton, a number of other people in this book, about your having your TV set. But 30% of that consumer rape and pillage is waste.
Oh yeah.
For instance,
oh, yeah.
the figure in The Economist, and I've quoted this before, The Economist magazine, which tends to be quite authoritative, the cost of traffic jams in America is $100 billion a year. At least it was 4 years ago. It's gone up. $100 billion. I mean, there's a gigantic amount of money. Sheer waste. You see, you can have all your stuff, but you don't have to have quite as much stuff. And I reckon that we could cut back by being prudent and sensible and clever by 30%.
Thomas Jefferson, not as hero, I've spent a lot of time in Canada, he's not as much a hero of mine as he is of other people's.
Yeah.
He had the solution to this. People should live in estates in the countryside, right, where they'd be master of whatever they surveyed in a rural splendor, and they could read thick books and meditate and so on. There's only one slight problem about this. it involves slavery. And as you know, there's a whole line of Jeffersons from the wrong side of the blanket.
Yes, he was quite shy about that.
Okay. Now, this is surely the point, that as long as you have a pre-industrial society, you are not going to give people whose sole contribution is human muscle power any command over there. This is something that we have to face. It is only when we replace human muscle power by some form of, but that's the only way we know how to do it at this moment, by some form of external energy, that, for instance, this was the great problem in Hong Kong. The Chinese and Scotchmen who actually ran the place, and still do for that matter, they didn't see why a rickshaw puller should be consulted about interest rates. And one can see their point of view. Now, hydraulic civilization, oh, interesting era that, isn't it? Hydraulic civilization, I'm thinking about Wittfogel and the book that enormously impressed me when I first read it. What we are saying is that the hydrocarbon civilization is riddled with things that anybody is going to regard as desirable and that we regard as desirable. Now that they don't come free, because all of these other schemes of sequestrating carbon and so on, and live in South Australia was Tim Flannery's solution to the problem. Everybody goes and lives in South Australia where they have...
he's coming back here.
Exactly, by plane. What I talk a great deal in the long piece, which I hope somebody will read.
It's a beautifully written piece.
Thank you. Edited, beautifully edited. She rewrote the whole thing. I talk a great deal in that about humanism. Now you can imagine what arrogance lies behind the idea that humanism is a good idea. Imagine if crocodiles took up crocodilism. The notion that our species has somehow some right to dominate, well, it's in the Bible, isn't it? We've been given dominion over... You might notice...
Fish and the fowl, yeah.
Etc. You might notice I'm much more respectful of religion than people of my opinions generally are. Not that I think it's true in any... It contains a psychological truth which you ignore at your peril. Because once again, the God hypothesis in some form or another is the most obvious way of explaining the complexities of the world that we live in.
Mm. I actually wrote about that in the previous edition of the Griffith Review. And I was trying to analyse how it is that science might account for belief in God or gods. You know, what is the evolutionary role of religious belief, because it exists in almost every human society. And a number of people have suggested explanations. Daniel Dennett, the philosopher, in his new book, has indicated that it might be the fact that if you're sitting around the campfire, you know, in the Stone Age culture, well, I mean, you can't watch telly, you can't watch The Bill, you've probably had your dinner. What else do you do all the time? You talk about the ancestors, because they're the people you remember. You dream about the ancestors. You ask, I suppose, rhetorically, what to do next about the problems. And having been talking to the
ancestors... You're respectful to the old, because they're closer to the ancestors.
That's right.
The next thing,
you're talking to a kind of father who isn't quite your father, but the father. Jared Diamond, and I think he's absolutely right, this has suggested a more political, social role for religion, and that is, if you've got a shaman and a fear of... the hereafter, then you can put up some kind of stick, some sort of tribal sign saying this is your God, this is your religion, and you shall unify behind this. In other words, it's a good way to keep people together. And so on the ideas
it's
go.
It's the only way to keep people together,
sure.
Because otherwise they have to belong to something. We are social animals. We all realise that that's what the endless fascination of Robinson Crusoe.
Yeah.
Is, could I make it alone? Answer, of course I couldn't.
Yeah.
And because we are social animals, and because through our weak jaws and excessive sized brain, we have the capacity to discuss things in the absence of the thing being discussed, which is what we're doing now.
Yes.
Although we have the magazine here, which you want everybody to read.
Well, on that, I would like now to see whether you have some questions. Obviously not to do with God, but to do with
climate change and hot air.
Which is what we're here to talk about. Now, I'm pretending that this is a radio program that we're going to stay on message. Yes, please. Green shirt.
I'm not very bright, so I look at the pictures in books rather than...
You look at the pictures,
rather
yes.
...rather than reading. I noticed in Tim Flannery's book, there's a picture about the carbon dioxide in the last 50 years. No, it's about the rainfall in the last 50 years.
Yes.
And there's also a picture on the internet, which I think the CSIRO produced, which is the same thing. And they don't agree with each other. Which one would you favour?
Murray.
Or maybe the noble, one of them is the noble lie. Perhaps both of them are the noble lie. I don't know. I mean, Flannery seemed a truthful little chap when I talked to him. as I say, we have the platonic noble lie, which he may be guilty of, I'm not sure. His publisher certainly was in putting the solution at the end of his book.
The other thing, when you mentioned Hayes, I read somewhere that if you look at the context in which he said in the long run we will be dead, he's not actually talking about just a way about the future. He's not trying to make that point. He's often quoted And the other thing that I thought about as you were talking was that as far as democracy is concerned, for one thing it was born in Greek civilization where they had slaves and took the crowd. Thank you. The other thing is that our great grandchildren don't have a vote.
What about the great-grandchildren not having a vote? I mean, that's pertinent, isn't it?
The great one?
The great-grandchildren do not have a vote, and what you're doing now, if you're wrong about climate, if you're deciding that we can do bugger all...
I'm not deciding that at all. I'm just saying that's what's going to happen. On previous form.
Yes. And
What else have we got to go on but previous form? You know how Europe solved its religious problems. Only Protestant, everybody was a Catholic up to 6,000 metres, I think it was, because the emperor could get his cannon that high. Above that, people could practice Protestantism. And which human problem has ever been solved, I would like to know, except the one about how to go to the dentist.
And I'm thinking, the sewage problem was solved. I was very impressed. 150 years ago, John Snow, you know, the Broad Street pump. The interesting thing is that Bazalgette, did you see the film series about great ideas of civilization? Well, Bazalgette happened to know about John Snow's ideas of what caused the cholera. And he spent 8 years, I think it was, fighting to produce the sewer system in London, which happened to get rid of cholera, just as John Snow hoped. Several years later, Bazalgette's great-grandson is with us again as the inventor of Big Brother on television. Do you see a certain symmetry there?
Let's look at the
sewage.
Let's look a little closer into the sewage, which will only take us a moment. As you know, the Ming civilization, the highest up to that point that human beings had achieved, or at least the most productive, had licked the nitrogen cycle by recycling feces back into the ground, right? Mm. That's what happened when I was a boy in Earlwood. I don't know what they did with that stuff, but I think it was recycled somewhere.
In Earlwood?
Yeah. Certainly we had the Dunny man came around and
etc.
Okay. Now, the cost of eliminating that solution to the nitrogen cycle has been to use fertilizer, and guess what fertilizer is made out of? Oil. And so we are trading what appears to be a solution for yet another mind-bending series of problems. But I'm sorry, where were we on?
Well, I was asking you to solve the world's problem. You said that we, by tradition, will do bugger all. What if we actually seized the moment and didn't do bugger all and did something? What would that something
what's
look like?
Well, we get into this. Get back to the Dutch. Dr. Johnson says that the cure of the ills of life is palliative and not radical. All you can do is apply patches. Now, obviously, if, as the graph strongly suggests, we're about to get into a rising water phase, then it might be a bad idea to lay in some sandbags and a shovel. Because it won't happen overnight, and it will happen gradually.
Well, London started doing that.
Yeah. What we are looking for now is, because such clever little chaps that we are, is some radical solution. There are no radical solutions to the evils of life. The human predicament, which must end in, will be galactic cat's meat one of these days.
Galactic cat's meat.
I rather like that. Yes, I've been trying to work it in for some time. The whole human experiment is doomed. Now, that raises some interesting questions. Let's have a good time while we're here. This is exactly what Byron said. I think I quoted him in the piece. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. That's one approach. It is not a negligible one. And patch and mend as far as we can, because that's what any human life consists of, patching and mending until we can patch and mend no longer.
Anyone want to make a point on it, please?
Two points I'd like to suggest. One is that I think that there's a reasonable assumption that we are making a contribution to this warming cycle, because we're reintroducing into the atmosphere the sun's energy, which was stored away millions of years ago.
True.
So we're putting back stored energy, which shouldn't necessarily be there at the present time, and the carbon dioxide comes with it. The second thing is, we may have the problem cured for us because we run out of oil. And in this case, if you start producing alcohol and biodiesel and things from plants, you will then be recycling your hydrocarbons instead of producing them from something which has been stored away below the surface of the earth for a few million years.
Everyone hear that?
Yeah. You're right, of course.
Outside as well.
It's plausible. What you say is absolutely plausible. Let me read you what...
May I just reiterate what was actually being said? If we run out of oil, then the solution would actually be thrust upon us, because we'll have to recycle. We'll have to use sustainable sources, in other words, biofuels and so on. And so the situation will be changed perforce. So.
Let me just read you, it would only take a moment, the advertisement in the same number of the New Yorker from Exxon. And it's plainly marked advertisement, and that's the most expensive part in the magazine, column in the magazine. Energy, the next 25 years, global demand to rise by as much as 50%, 70% of increase in the developing world. Wind and solar, even with rapid growth, to meet about 1% of total world demand by 2030. Close to 60% to be met by oil and natural gas, and then they give a source. For all the long-term potential of alternatives, there is as yet no easy way to meet the world's growing demand for energy and slow the rate of emissions. That's why at ExxonMobil, we're doing all we can to develop resources responsibly. Learn more at ExxonMobil. Now, when I look up, I think you did it first, Julian. When I look up their website, you get a very expensive website, and it has one of those flags running across it, an illuminated slogan. And the flag says, energy is essential to economic progress all over the world. Energy is essential to economic progress all over the world. What they say is, ever more energy is essential. That's what they should say, is essential to economic progress, whatever economic progress means. All over the world. Next door to it, it has stock price $60.45 is up, you'll be glad to know, $0.56. Now, when we then look up Exxon on the New York Stock Exchange, we discovered that they only have one responsibility. It's to return a dividend to their shareholders. That's the law. If they were doing anything else, they also have a piece called good corporate citizenship. Now, this somehow assumes that a corporation is a living human being. It has a personality. Or somebody said a headless monster with invisible hands. Mm. It's just a bunch of people trying to get more out than they put in.
And they got an awful lot out, didn't they? 50 billion.
But that's the nature of their business. They do not make a secret of it.
But you see, it's the way that they were competing, for instance, Beyond Petroleum, which used to be called British Petroleum.
Yeah.
Which went green for a little bit and then saw what Exxon was doing and how they're being left behind. And as they say in the great phrase, chucked a Huey very quickly and changed their policy back again in many ways. So if you simply wait for the fuel companies to change, I think it'll be a rather long time. What I'll just say briefly is that Mark Diesendorf and Hugh Sadler have published a paper analysing how renewables can now make Australia self-sufficient.
Oh, we'd be easy.
It can be done now.
It would be easy because we've got so much land, we could be growing sugar cane and so on. We're not the problem.
Mm.
Because what... We all know what the answer to the population problem is. Educating women. Simple as that.
Sure.
The Philippines. Uh, 3.11 babies per woman. China, 1.73 babies per woman. By the way, 2.1 is reproduction, keeps the numbers steady. Female literacy in China, 86%. India, 2.73 babies per woman. That's way above, it almost doubles in 50 years. You can do the maths for me. Female literacy, 48.3%. But then we face a whole new set of problems. China will then have the oldest population in the world. One Chinese will be sweating to support three Chinese, either education or beyond the age of work. And there's no China beyond China to supply, etc. So that, in other words, the problem, if you want to look at it that way, is likely to suddenly reverse. Under those circumstances, all that's going to keep these Chinese going are fossil fuels. But while we can grow as much bagasse, et cetera, as in this enormous country, we could stop putting in wine or maybe run cars on wine. Probably work.
No, that's not. I ran a story from St. Yeah. Louis. You can run a mobile phone on a booze battery.
Yeah.
You can. The suggestion is that the push from hydrogen and alcohol as an alternative is going to come via laptops and mobile phones. Not directly through transport, but transport will be pushed because of those smaller applications happening very quickly. I think it's very interesting.
But all I've got to say in this is that before we seek radical solutions, let us attempt to understand the nature of the problem.
Sure.
And as humble scribblers, that's all we can do. Nobody's going to listen to us.
Oh, well...
They might even read us if they're
well. We have one last point if you want to. Yes, please.
I am spoken with a thing called Future World.
Yeah. You're with Future World, yes?
Yeah, Future World, which demonstrates environmentally friendly technologies and makes people more aware of all these various problems. And we have a lot of children through the centre from schools, and they are excited by the new technologies. They're very aware now through the teaching and through what we're showing them.
Children are excited by the new technology, yes.
To solve our problems. And my motivation, which I'm doing in my retirement,
yes.
considerable time and so on, I look at my grandchildren and I think I'm growing up in a world a bit like Africa at the moment, parts of Africa. And I can see that coming, unless
sure.
There's a desertification, pollution, every
The four horsemen.
And that's my motivation.
Yeah.
I'm trying to prevent my grandchildren.
Trying to prevent grandchildren, I'm just interpreting for those who are not necessarily in the room. May I make a quick comment on that? I interviewed somebody who's actually called Tim Jones, despite the fact that he's a Western Cherokee Indian in Arizona. He's a professor of anthropology, and he did the study on food waste. $48.3 billion worth of food is thrown away by American households. And he's done a follow-up. This is not supermarkets or restaurants, just households. I think the full figure is, again, $120 billion American dollars. So my question to him is, as an anthropologist, why are people throwing away so much good food? And he said they don't know where food comes from. And if you ask the children, they have absolutely no, they think it comes from in plastic packets and is either green or red, depending on. So what he said we should do, and this is, pertains to children and being involved in some scientific understanding of nature, his recommendation was two things. First of all, in the primary schools or before, they grow vegetables and have them for lunch. Second, they visit abattoirs. I'm afraid. It might be a shock, but that will be the smack of the reality, perhaps. Do you want to comment on kids, Murray?
Well, I was listening to Philip Adams for a change instead of him listening to me, but...
You interrupted each other, yeah.
He's made a great discovery that, as you know, he's not very keen on religion. That he discovered that the two American states, Mississippi and Alabama, had the highest level of religious believers. They also had the highest level of illegitimacy. So he said, ah, it just shows you these hypocritical religious people don't practice what they preach. But it also has the highest level of obesity in the world, those two states. And he has misinterpreted this. Something independent is causing all three. Poverty.
Yep, that's right.
So that, in other words, the wasting of food that you talk about is caused by poverty.
Mm.
That's the surprising thing. That the portions of food that are dished out, which is being thrown away, is because of the competition
yep.
between them. This is exactly what Marx said, that it is the tendency of systems that rely on getting out more than you put in to keep on competing away until disastrous results.
Well, can I give you another example of this question of waste? $120 billion per annum is the cost of diabetes in America, directly as a result of obesity. Diet and the treatment of food complaints is predicted by Ellen Ruppel Shell to be costing the world in a few years' time $1 trillion American dollars a year. I mean, we have leeway in which to change things dramatically without anyone doing without a nice little piece of flashy transport or a nice dinner. You know, you're not going to be deprived of any of these things. So that's the paradox.
When I was young, capitalists used to have great big stomachs in cartoons because people assumed they had enough money.
Hats,
they had enough money to buy a lot of food.
Yeah.
If you look at the capitalists now, they're all as thin as rakes.
Yeah.
It's the poor who have large stomachs.
Right. Yeah.
Now, in other words, we are misinterpreting that we are glibly assuming that what is a cause is in fact simply another effect, yet another effect. What lies at the heart of all this?
Indeed.
This is what we have to ask.
We'll take it a bit further tomorrow when we have a panel which is on at 3:30 with several of us authors. When I shall, for instance, talk about the evidence versus the politics, there seems to be a conflict between the two. And you'll have Ian Lowe and young Flannery?
No, Peter Doherty.
Peter Doherty. He's a young guy too.
It's my young guy's panel tomorrow.
He got the Nobel Prize in 1995, I think. And one more? Murray?
Murray again. Yes.
Murray again, yeah. We'll talk about God and the universe and everything. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks, Murray.